Right, 2 Samuel 17. We're going to tackle for our study today a big section. We're going to try and study the entire chapter today. 29 verses. I'll read it, but just as a brief reminder of where we're at in the context of David's unfolding story. David is in flight. He's left the city of Jerusalem. He has traveled up the incline of the Mount of Olives, and he's now on the far side, and he is finding refuge and relative safety and protection in the wilderness. The reason he is heading for the wilderness is because his son Absalom has fomented a rebellion against his own father's authority, has stolen the kingdom from him, stolen the kingship from him. And as David is fleeing the city of Jerusalem, Absalom is entering the city and is being established as the newly appointed, in this case, self-appointed king of Israel. And so that's where we pick up our story. We've recently studied a series of five key encounters. These are spiritual, God-ordained encounters that David had with different individuals as he was leaving the city of Jerusalem. The Lord graciously meeting David at different stages as he exited the city and fled into the wilderness, meeting him through these individuals. Some of them encouraging, strengthening encounters and meetings, and others that were additional tests and challenges for David. And let's keep in mind the big picture here of what's going on. There's a reason why things are apparently falling apart in David's life, and not just at a minor level, but in the most serious ways. I mean, if you can only imagine, again, just putting yourself for a moment back in his position, your own most dearly loved son, and that's who Absalom was to him, has, you know, stabbed his own father in the back, so to speak, and has stolen the kingdom from him. And all of this is taking place, of course, because David had sinned against the Lord, and sinned against the Lord in a very, very serious way, with a sin of adultery with Bathsheba, and then compounded that sin of adultery by attempting to hide it and arranging for the murder of her husband. And even though David has repented of his sin, and even though David has been forgiven graciously, mercifully by the Lord for his sin, the Lord has also ordained ongoing, long-term consequences for him. Those consequences are designed by the Lord. Even though they're difficult and deeply so, they are ordained for David's benefit, because these consequences are going to train his heart so that he will never again fall into the pattern of sin that he had fallen into before. So the series of long-term consequences are intended to instruct David's heart and to sanctify David's heart and to serve as a warning sign in history through David's example for all of us. We're meant to learn from his failures, his mistakes, and what he had to deal with in the aftermath of his sinful failures, so that we can avoid the pitfalls that David himself fell into. So that brings us up to chapter 17. This is going to involve a key circumstance right after Absalom now has been established in the city of Jerusalem as the new king. And there are two counselors that Absalom is going to be listening to. These two key figures are Ahithophel, who was formerly David's most trusted counselor and wise counselor, and Hushai. Ahithophel is no longer loyal to David. He has thrown all of his support behind the new king, Absalom. And we've identified that he's done so, most likely Ahithophel has, because he's motivated. He's motivated in an unhealthy way, probably because of family connection. We've seen that Ahithophel, as we backtrack through the descriptions of family relationships, was the grandfather of Bathsheba. And what the implication is that Ahithophel is still embittered toward David for that whole circumstance. And so he has He has left behind his loyalty to David, and he has become loyal to his son Absalom, not because he sees such great qualities in Absalom, but because he has a desire to get even, to get revenge on David for how David, in his perspective, has ruined his family. And then we have another counselor that's going to appear in this chapter whose name is Hushai. He's one of the five key encounters that David had. He remains loyal to David, and David has actually asked him, rather than to accompany David into the wilderness while he's fleeing from Absalom, he's asked Hushai to go back into the city and secretly present himself to Absalom as though he were loyal to Absalom, but remaining loyal to David for two purposes. He wants Hushai to give counsel to Absalom, hoping that Hushai can influence Absalom for David's benefit, and he wants Hushai to serve as a conduit of secret information being sent back to David through a network of messengers. So with that background, let's read all of chapter 17 of 2 Samuel. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all of the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say." And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is expert in war. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, 'There has been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant men whose heart is like the heart of a lion will utterly melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you, from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, and both of them, by the way, were also remaining loyal to David, "Thus and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so have I counseled. Now, therefore, send quickly and tell David, 'Do not stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up.' Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz were waiting at En-Rogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom, so both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Bahurim, who had a well in his courtyard. They went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it, and nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, 'Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?' And the woman said to them, 'They have gone over the brooks of water.' And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. After they had gone, the men came up out of the well and went and told King David. They said to David, "Arise and go quickly over the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you." Then David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra, the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash, aren't you glad that you don't have to pronounce all these names? When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lo-Debar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogelim, brought beds, basins, earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd, for David and the people with him to eat. For they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." All right, long story and a lot of different elements here, but a couple of key ones. I want to describe this teaching by titling it today, Protection and Provision. And while we can't get the full concept on a CD, I would really call this Protection and Provision in the Wilderness. What we have here, of course, is David fleeing, as the story unfolds, across the River Jordan. The River Jordan should immediately alert our biblical familiarity to something significant and important in Israel, Israel's history far before this date. The River Jordan, of course, was the eastern boundary line of the actual promised land. The River Jordan was that natural geographic boundary line that distinguished and marked off two categories geographically, but really that had spiritual significance for the children of Israel as Moses had led the people of God, the children of Israel, out of Egypt and through a 40-year-long journey in the wilderness. They spent 40 years in the wilderness between Egypt and the Promised Land. And when they reached the end of that 40-year journey, by God's direction and guidance, they came to the River Jordan. And they camped there on the far side, the eastern shore of the River Jordan. And before they entered the land, Moses died there. The Lord ordained for Joshua to take his place to lead the people. And Joshua's first action to lead the people was to lead them across the River Jordan and into, for the first time, the Promised Land. So David now has actually, though he was not there before in that generation, he is in a sense now following in the footsteps of Israel, but in reverse. And it's an important spiritual connection for us to notice. The Lord led Israel out of captivity through the wilderness into the land of promise, which symbolized or signified the Lord's land of blessing and fruitfulness for their trust and faithfulness to the Lord. Now David is coming from the land of promise. He's coming from the land of fruitfulness, the land of blessing, and leaving it behind and crossing the same river into the wilderness, which was for Israel marked not by fruitfulness and blessing, but by what? Testing. It was a series of 10 tests that the Lord took the children of Israel through in their 40-year journey through the wilderness. So now David is leaving behind fruitfulness and blessing, and he's entering into a time again of great testing. And all of that, the reason why he's following Israel's footsteps in reverse is because of his sin. The point that we're meant to notice is sin takes us into the wilderness. Faithfulness brings us into, by the grace of God, the land of fruit, the land of promise, the land of blessing, the land of peace. And so he's lost, at least temporarily, all of that because of his own sin, and he's entering into a time of testing. But, thankfully, because the Lord is so gracious, because the Lord is so merciful, because the Lord has a continuing purpose for David's life, in spite of his sin, in spite of his weakness, in spite of his failure, the Lord is not abandoning him in the wilderness. He's going into the wilderness, but the Lord's going with him. The Lord's watching out over him. The Lord is going to deal with him while he's there. The Lord is going to protect him, even when he's unable to protect himself. And he's going to supernaturally, if necessary, as we'll see here in this chapter's events, he's going to even supernaturally provide for him, just like the Lord supernaturally provided for Israel in the duration of their time in the wilderness. But the chapter begins with an appeal by Ahithophel. Remember, he's the unfaithful, formerly loyal counselor of David, most trusted counselor, who has now gone over to Absalom's support. And Ahithophel is trusted by Absalom as his number one counselor. And Ahithophel comes to Absalom at this key moment, the same day that David has fled the city, the same day that Absalom has entered the city of Jerusalem and been established as the new king. Ahithophel comes to Absalom and says, look, let me do this. Let me take an army of 12,000 men and pursue your father. He's saying he's not that far ahead of us. We can pursue him through the night, catch up to him. He's going to be worn out, he and the men that have followed him, because they knew, Absalom and Ahithophel knew, there was a small army of men who had gone with David. Remember from our encounters, one of those encounters that David had on the ascent of the Mount of Olives was with Ittai the Gittite. And remember, Ittai brought with him a small army of loyal soldiers that were going to act as David's personal guard on the way into the wilderness. And he had some 600 soldiers with him. And there's implication that others have begun to gather with David. We don't know the exact number, but it's still a relatively small army. And so Ahithophel wisely recognizes this is a critical moment of opportunity for Absalom. And he recognizes that if we act now, if we act while David is worn out from the day's events, and no doubt David was worn out, not just physically worn out from having to walk from the city of Jerusalem all the way down into the Kidron Valley, all the way up the Mount of Olives, all the way to the far side, to the city that he ends up with, you know, ends up with at the far side of the Mount of Olives. He's not just physically worn out, as we talked about before, no doubt emotionally drained by the events of the day. I mean, you know how it is. You've had particularly difficult, challenging days, and you come home, and at the end of the day, I mean, you're spent. You're exhausted. And sometimes there's a physical component to that, but oftentimes there's that stress component that can wear you out more deeply to the bone than even physical exhaustion can. And we can safely conclude that David's had that kind of a day. I called it in an earlier teaching, the worst day of David's life. And so Ahithophel wisely sees David and his men are going to be spent. They're going to be exhausted. They haven't had time to get organized as an actual army yet. They haven't had time to set up strategies and encamp as an army should encamp. They're just fleeing. They're just getting out of the city. And if I take an army of 12,000 men with me, that's at least 6-1 odds in Ahithophel's favor. I can pursue him. I can catch up with him. We can take them by surprise. And what we'll do, as he's appealing to Absalom, what we'll do is we're not going to try to wipe out all the men that are with David. We're going to try to isolate David from his guard, and we'll just kill him. And once we've killed him, once we've executed your father, then the remainder of his people, we will welcome back under your leadership as the new king. And we will have a unified new nation of Israel under your rulership as king. That was Ahithophel's plan. The question is, was it a good plan? The answer is yes and no. Yes and no. Classic Bible scenario here. Yes, it was a good plan in the sense of if we could theoretically leave the Lord out of the equation, if we could leave the Lord out of the circumstance, if we could pretend that this is the way the world works, there is no God, it's just all what goes on a horizontal level here on the surface of the planet. You against me, my plan against your plan, my army against your army, and that's all that's involved in this situation. If that were the case, it wasn't just a good plan, it was a brilliant plan, and it would have worked exactly the way Ahithophel expected it to work. David and his men were exhausted. They were worn out. They didn't plan to be attacked that night. In those days, nobody attacked in the middle of the night. You know, we have many famous stories in military history, if you study the story of great battles in history, where, you know, wise and strategic generals make these plans to, you know, we'll march through the middle of the night and we'll catch them off guard at dawn. No one did that in those days. You know, they fought wars and battles in broad daylight where everybody could see what was going on. Ahithophel came up with an incredibly brilliant maneuver here strategically and would have won a total victory over David. But Ahithophel failed to consider one simple key factor. This world doesn't exist without God. The Lord was involved in the circumstance. And what didn't Ahithophel consider? He didn't consider what God was going to do. All he considered was what David was doing. He didn't think vertically. He just thought horizontally. And as far as his horizontal plans were concerned, surface of the planet plans, they were brilliant. But the big picture is, as we read the story, the Lord is the master general, the master strategist, the ruler of the battlefield above and beyond any earthly plans and strategies. And Ahithophel formed his plan and appeal as if God didn't even exist. There's no consideration on his part at all. I wonder what's going on between the Lord and David right now. I wonder if the Lord will allow us to have victory over David. There's no appeal to the Lord here. There's no truly wise counsel. What should he have counseled Absalom? What he should have counseled Absalom is, instead of going immediately for a military solution, he should have counseled Absalom, you're the new king. First thing you need to do, you need to stop and seek the Lord. Before you do anything, before you act left, right, forward, back, stop, go, up, down, you need to stop and consider where you stand with the Lord and where your father stands with the Lord and get clear in your heart and mind what the will of the Lord is for this circumstance. That's what he should have counseled him. But of course, Ahithophel wasn't in a healthy place spiritually. So how can he, if he's not in a healthy place, how can he give healthy counsel? He can't. So he's locked in. He's locked in with this revenge motive against David, and that's all he can see. Ahithophel's got what we call tunnel vision. All he can see is he's got David in his grasp, and if Absalom will simply give him 12,000 men to run off into battle with, that he will surely kill David and satisfy his own bloodlust and satisfy, of course, the desire of Absalom to take control of his kingdom and finally be rid of his father, who Absalom sees as the domineering influence over his life. And so he lays out this plan, and of course, Absalom, as he hears the plan, is very much impressed with it, as he should have been. It was an impressive plan. As I said, naturally speaking, militarily, strategically brilliant. And Absalom was duly impressed with the plan. And not just Absalom. The text tells us Absalom and who else was impressed with the plan? All the elders of Israel. Now, who are the elders of Israel? These are not just the old guys. The term means those that are the mature and wise ones in the community of Israel. All of the ones that should have been able to see clearly what's really going on in this circumstance. The ones that through life experience would have known, if anyone should have known, you don't leave the Lord out of the equation. And yet they, along with Absalom, just they hear the practically, you know, strategically wise advice of Ahithophel, and they're just impressed with it. And they just, that's a great plan, let's do that. Which tells us something about not just Ahithophel's heart condition, it tells us something about Absalom's heart condition. And it tells us something about the heart condition of all these elders of Israel. They're not, none of them are in a healthy place. They're all easily impressed by foolish counsel. On the surface, it's wise. And naturally speaking, it makes sense. But spiritually, anytime you leave the Lord out of your plans, they are doomed to fail. No matter how smart your plans may seem at the moment that you are making them. And the one thing that Ahithophel and Absalom and the elders of Israel failed to discern is this. The Lord wanted David alive. So I don't care what plan you have to kill David. If the Lord wants him alive, how successful is your plan going to be? And not only did the Lord want David alive, he also wanted Absalom dead. So, the wise counsel of Ahithophel is going to fall. And so, even though Absalom is impressed with his counsel, as soon as he hears it, he does something that Ahithophel had not expected or anticipated. He calls for a second voice of counsel. He says, okay, I'm impressed with your plan. I think that's a great plan. But you know what? I think what I'll do is I want to hear from Hushai the Archite as well. Now, remember, Hushai's returned to the city. He remains loyal to David. And he is also a wise counselor. But his reputation was that he was not as wise, as effective of a counselor as Ahithophel. Nevertheless, Absalom says, okay, I've got the best counselor's advice. Now I need to listen to this other guy. So he brings Hushai the Archite in, and Hushai is going to give him a completely different kind of counsel. But what I want us to recognize here is that in Ahithophel's counsel, first and foremost, even though it made sense and it was strategically smart and it would have been effective on a natural level if we could leave the Lord out of the equation, so therefore it was, on a natural level, good advice, and it would have worked. But good advice is not always right advice in life. There's a lot. I was having dinner with a couple last night, and we were discussing in the conversation the relative merits of biblical perspective on understanding human behavior versus psychological principles of understanding human behavior. And we were discussing some of the foundations and the roots behind a psychological worldview and a psychological way to understand what makes a human human, what makes people tick, what makes them behave in the way that they do, and how, while there are some accurate conclusions in the psychological worldview, how at the root, though, of that perspective, they leave out some very important factors in understanding human behavior, like little details like the Lord, little details like sin and its effect on the human heart and all the behavior that flows from the human heart. And so there's lots of quote-unquote good counsel in the psychological world, but is it right counsel? In the same way here, Ahithophel gives good counsel, but it's not right because it's not in agreement with the will of the Lord. And so Absalom calls for a second counselor. And I want us to look at three passages. We'll of course come back to 2 Samuel, so don't lose your place there. But turn over, I want to get us three passages in the book of Proverbs. And what we're considering here with these three passages is the idea that Absalom had to, he listened to the good counsel of Ahithophel, but then he stops before he acts and calls for a second counselor. I want us to consider these three passages in that context. Proverbs 11:14. It says, where there is no guidance, a people falls. But in an abundance of counselors, there is safety. Where there's no guidance, a people falls, but in an abundance of counselors, there is safety. Second passage, also in Proverbs. We'll look in chapter 15, verse 22. Similar theme. Without counsel, plans fail. But with many advisors, they succeed. Okay. Without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. Third passage, Proverbs 24, verse 6. For by wise guidance you can wage your war, and in abundance of counselors, there is victory. All right, so here is, by the way, these three verses were not written at the time of Absalom. These were going to later in the near future be written by another son of David, Solomon. But the principles were just as true in Absalom's day, even though they hadn't yet been written as scripture. The principle remains true in every generation. So here's Absalom. He's in a circumstance where he wants to go out and wage war against his own father. And the book of Proverbs would tell us, if you're going to go out and wage war, if you want victory, what should you do before you go out and start the battle? You should gather more than one counselor and listen to what they have to say. And if you do that, the indication is, in the passages we just read, your plans will succeed, you will win victory in the battle, and you will find safety at the end of the battle. So what Absalom does is he hears the good counsel of one counselor, Ahithophel, and he likes that advice, but rather than just immediately acting on it, he exercises some normally wise behavior. And he seeks out the counsel of a second counselor. He brings a second counselor in, thus ensuring himself that his plans will succeed, he will have victory against his father David, and he will find safety at the end of the battle, right? And not so fast. What's going to happen is he's going to bring the second counselor in. The second counselor is actually secretly loyal not to him but to his father David. He's going to give very wise and very strategic advice, which on the surface appears to benefit Absalom, but actually is designed to benefit David. He's going to be deceived by that counsel, Absalom is, and he's going to choose the second counselor's advice over the first. The first would have worked to his benefit. The second works to his detriment. But he's going to choose the second, and he is going to go out into battle, and he's going to be killed in the battle. He will not succeed in defeating his father. He will not find safety. He will not find victory. He will find judgment and death. So, is the book of Proverbs in those three verses wrong? No, because the implication in all three of those verses is that we're seeking, of course, it doesn't specify this, but this is the clear implication in context, that we're seeking wise counsel in each case, and that in our desire to seek counsel and in the counselors that we seek, that neither us nor the counselors are leaving the Lord out of the equation. And see, this again is Absalom's big problem, and it's Ahithophel's big problem, is the Lord will not be left out. We can attempt to leave him out. We can attempt to ignore him. I mentioned in our recent study that the one thing that was dramatically missing from Absalom's arrival in the city of Jerusalem and installment as the new king is there's no mention of the Lord. He doesn't consider the Lord at all. David, when he became king, you know, he focused all of his attention on the Lord's purpose in making him king. And then even after being installed as king, his first priority was to go and bring the Ark of the Covenant into the city of Jerusalem to signify his heart's desire to be close to the presence of the Lord and to give the Lord first place in his kingdom. This is what defined David as, in spite of his weaknesses, character flaws, and failures, the man that the Lord identified and described in other places as a man after his own heart, a true shepherd of Israel. Absalom is not concerned about any of these things. He's not concerned about the presence of the Lord. He's not concerned about the will of the Lord. He's concerned and absorbed only with his own selfish desires. And no matter what counsel he may seek, the Lord is going to work through that counsel in order to bring about his will for Absalom's life, because the Lord will not be ignored. He will not be left out of the equation. He will, if we leave him out, he will establish his own place to our detriment. And it certainly was ultimately to Absalom's detriment. So Hushai brought counsel. And Hushai's counsel was, on the surface, again, very wise in the ears of Absalom. And it truly was wise. It just wasn't wise in the way that Absalom was hearing it. He thought it was wise that Hushai was giving him advice that if he followed it, would give him more safety, more victory over his father, and establish him more completely in the kingdom. But it was truly wise because it would lead to the accomplishment of the will of the Lord. And the will of the Lord in this case was to preserve David's life alive and to bring Absalom under deserved judgment. So it wasn't wise in the way that Absalom wanted it to be, but it was ultimately the wisest counsel in the circumstance. Hushai spoke in a very wise way. First, when he was first brought before Absalom and asked, you know, he was told, this is what Ahithophel has counseled me to do. What do you have to say? First, he just boldly and directly undercut the integrity and the seeming wisdom of Ahithophel's counsel by saying to the king, and he does it in a very smart way, this time Ahithophel's counsel is not good. Which is what he's doing, is he's acknowledging, because he can't deny this, and if he had denied it, the king would have stopped listening to him. He can't deny that Ahithophel has given very good counsel in the past. He had a reputation. There was an earlier passage in one of the earlier chapters in which Ahithophel's advice, it says that he was so wise in his counsel, it was as if God himself was speaking through him when he normally gave his counsel. And so Hushai wisely acknowledged his reputation by saying, implying, most every time this man has given counsel, it's been the best advice and the best counsel, and it always works, but not this time. So he's immediately created a doubt in Absalom's mind by saying, this is the exception. This time, Ahithophel has not seen the circumstance clearly. He also goes on to say, this is not good counsel this time. What he means by that is, because he understands that it is strategically good, it would work. In fact, Hushai is so convinced that Ahithophel's counsel would work that even after he convinces the king to follow his counsel, he still sends secret messengers back to David to tell him to get across the River Jordan in case, in the middle of the night, Absalom wakes up and decides to follow the original counsel given to him by Ahithophel and actually ends up winning a victory over his father. So he knows it's strategically good, but what he also understands is it's not morally and spiritually good, that the counsel he gives is not really good because it does not reflect and represent the will of the Lord for David's life and for Absalom's life. And then what he does very wisely, Hushai, in giving his advice to the king, is he plays up the legend of David. He reminds Absalom with the intention of creating doubt and fear in Absalom's heart toward his father. And no doubt, Absalom did have doubt and fear. That's why he didn't just rush out of the city and why he was seeking counsel. He knew something about his father, and what he knew, and from his father's reputation, of course, David was the greatest warrior ever in Israel's history up until this point. He had won many battles. They used to sing songs in Israel about the battles that David had won. Now, of course, one thing that I think Ahithophel understood, the first counselor, is that that was a long time ago. That was in David's younger days. He's become settled now as king. He hasn't gone out to battle in a long time. And at this moment, at the end of this long day and night, David is not effectively leading an army out there in the wilderness. He's just hiding. He's just fleeing. But that's not what Hushai emphasizes. He emphasizes the legend of King David. And he describes him as, and the soldiers that are following him, of they're like a bear that's been robbed of its cubs. You know, you don't want to mess with that bear. And, you know, even if he is hiding, he's not hiding with his army. He's got his people camped over here, and then he's in a secret place. And as soon as you try to go and attack him, he's going to swoop out of that secret place, and he's going to devastate the force that you send against him. And then word will get out to all Israel that David is defeating his son Absalom, and your whole new kingdom scheme is going to crumble in front of your eyes. And Hushai advises him instead, and what you should do is wait and gather all of the forces of Israel in a gigantic, massive army. Wait until David finds a city to flee to and to encamp in, and then we'll mass ourselves, this giant army, against that city, and we'll defeat him, and we will wipe out all the soldiers. Remember, Ahithophel's advice was, let's just separate David and only kill him and unify the nation. But what Hushai does is he plays on Absalom's bloodlust, his desire to devastate David and all of his followers and to wreak vengeance on them. And it does appeal to Absalom, this idea of forming this massive army to go against David. And so Ahithophel and his better strategic counsel is denied by Absalom. And Hushai, though his counsel is spiritually and morally superior but strategically inferior, is accepted and embraced. And Absalom ends up concluding, Hushai's counsel is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. And Absalom alone doesn't conclude that. All of the elders with him conclude that. They all draw the wrong conclusion, and we're given, and this is a helpful but unexpected commentary in the narration of the story. Sometimes when we have stories like this, all we have is narration, where the Lord is just through the eyewitnesses describing the events for us. In this case, we have a single verse that's dropped in, which is the writer's commentary on the event, so that we don't miss the key development, which is really happening at a deeper, hidden, unseen level. Let's go back to that passage and identify that verse of commentary. Let's look in verse... where is it? 14, thank you. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel." For, and this is the commentary that the writer adds under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, "For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." All right, so the commentary is added so that we wouldn't miss the point. What's the point? Is that naturally speaking, there's no reason to not follow the counsel of Ahithophel and to substitute the strategically inferior counsel of Hushai. The only explanation for why this developed the way that it did is because the Lord was working not just in David's life directly, but he was working in Absalom's mind, causing him to draw the wrong conclusion about the counsel that he heard. And he was working through the words of Hushai, and he was also working in the minds of all of the elders who were with Absalom to cause them also to draw the wrong conclusion about which was the strategically superior counsel. What we have here is a dramatic display of the awesome sovereignty of God working above the scene. Like these individuals' lives are pieces on a chessboard, and God is moving them to serve his greater purpose. And while that concept of God's sovereignty is for us somewhat unsettling at first glance, because it seems like, you know, gosh, I mean, really? I mean, was God that involved in even causing their thoughts to move a certain direction and draw certain conclusions? And it just seems to us to be, you know, a very difficult concept to embrace. Yet ultimately, we need to understand he's doing all this for his gracious and glorifying purpose in the end of the story. He's working in a hidden way in the hearts of even ungodly men. Absalom was not in a good place. He was stabbing his own father in the back. He was a murderer. He was a kingdom thief. And yet the Lord was in his mind causing him to disregard the counsel that would lead him to victory and embrace the counsel that was going to lead him to his own death and defeat. But God was doing it to preserve David's life alive and to fulfill his great calling and purpose through David. It's an awesome display of God's sovereignty in this circumstance. And so Absalom chooses the second counsel to follow, and Hushai sends word through his network of messengers back to David, and there's an interesting story of how the two messengers are almost caught as they're carrying the message of safety back to David and wise advice on how to escape from Absalom's clutches. They're almost caught, and yet the Lord watches over them and provides for them, much like it's very similar to the story of the two spies that were preserved alive by the efforts of Rahab back when the Lord was first bringing Israel into the promised land from their journey out of the wilderness into the promised land. And here the Lord is working in a very similar way on David's behalf, even though he's moving in reverse from the promised land into the wilderness. Nevertheless, the Lord is even working outside of David's awareness to preserve alive the men that are bringing that important message to him. And then, of course, Ahithophel evaluates what has just happened. And he recognizes and sees that his counsel has been disregarded by the new king. His advice has not been followed, and he makes a dramatic decision. He decides to leave the city of Jerusalem, gets on his donkey, travels back to his home, sets his household affairs in order, and he does like Judas did, and he hangs himself. And what we're meant to see is there's a similarity of connection there. David representing to us the role of Christ at this moment in history. Jesus later choosing to even describe himself and identify himself in his own calling as the son of David. And Ahithophel, his formerly trusted counselor, acting in a circumstance of deep betrayal to his Lord and master. But his plans not unfolding the way he thought they would unfold. And him not gaining the revenge on David that he thirsted for and lusted for. And so he hangs himself. And it really is a tragic end of Ahithophel, a man who I'll call a wise but foolish man. You know, how can you be both wise and foolish at the same time? Well, look at Ahithophel. That's how you do it. He was wise in the sense that he was just filled with all of this experienced counsel, able to discern circumstances and give just the right advice, but purely on a horizontal level, his tragedy not just was the last event of his life, his hanging, his tragedy was that he left the Lord out of his life. You know, when David took advantage of his granddaughter, and you can understand if you're a grandfather how you would react in that circumstance. I don't blame Ahithophel for being angry with David. But you resolve that before the Lord. You don't resolve that by seeking to kill the man that destroyed your family in your eyes. And yet Ahithophel's left the Lord out of his life and out of his perspective. And so his life ends in the most tragic way of all, suicide. This isn't the only suicide in the Bible. There are a few of them, but in every single case, every single Bible example of suicide, you see a similar characteristic of the heart of the person that commits suicide. The Lord is absent from their thoughts. The Lord is absent from their concerns, and they are selfishly pursuing their own agenda. And they reach the end of that pathway and realize how empty that path is and how empty their life has become by pursuing that path. And they end that path in the most tragic way of all. And Ahithophel did that. His heart was filled, instead of with the Lord, his heart was filled with these two deep character flaws: the lust for revenge against David and pride. What pride? The pride of my counsel wasn't followed. The new king didn't listen to me. He listened to Hushai instead. I can't live with that. I can't stand not having my voice being the predominant voice of wisdom and counsel in the kingdom. I just can't handle that. I can't live with that. And he didn't. So his character flaws ruined his wisdom in the end. And his wisdom turned into the ultimate expression of foolishness at the end of his story. Then the scene shifts back to David now. And David crosses the River Jordan based upon the secret messengers that Hushai sent to him for his safety. And in crossing the River Jordan, he has now left the promised land. Not just left the city of Jerusalem, he's left the promised land. He's now on the east side of the River Jordan. He is in what technically was for Israel during their 40-year journey, the wilderness. And we're given a confirmation of that in the very last verse of the chapter. Let's just remind ourselves of that. As it's talking about different supplies that were sent to David in the wilderness or brought to him, it says, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And that's not just a geographic description. That's meant to remind us of the events of the book of Exodus. It's meant to remind us that David now is reliving the wilderness journey of Israel, but he's doing it in reverse. And so he's in the wilderness, and he settles in a city. The name of the city he settles in, and this is not accidental, most of these events, and I would say most, I say all of these events that are unfolding in the scripture as the narrative stories of David's life and the other characters that God chooses to focus our attention on in his word. These events are not accidental, they're not circumstantial. They're purposeful. They bear spiritual significance if we look for it and listen to what the text is telling us. You know, we've studied as a church the significance of biblical names and how names conveyed certain meanings, certain principles. And in this case, where David settles is not accidental. It is purposeful. He settles in Mahanaim. This location has some spiritual history to it. I won't turn us there, but if you're taking notes or you want to read it later, this is a reference to Genesis chapter 32, verses 1 and 2, from the life of Jacob, one of course, the three great patriarchs of Israel's early history, Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob. Jacob, in a critical testing time of his life, had left his father-in-law Laban's house and started out on a journey to return to his family and to meet up with his brother Esau. And he was anticipating not a happy family reunion with Esau. He was anticipating that Esau was going to want to kill him because he had stabbed Esau in the back and had stolen Esau's birthright from him and had done so through deception and knew that Esau had been embittered toward him because of that. And on his route back to Esau, before he met up with him, the Lord graciously met with him before he met with Esau. And in Genesis 32, 1 and 2, the Lord doesn't first meet with him directly, but sends messengers to meet with him. And he has a meeting with angels on the road to encounter Esau. And as he meets with those angels, Jacob has a spiritual insight that the Lord gives him, that the Lord is at work in his life in a way that he hadn't seen. And he names the place where he met with the angels of the Lord Mahanaim. And the term literally means two camps. What it meant for Jacob is he was camped there, but what he had not been aware of was that it was also God's camp. And that there was more going on than just the natural horizontal circumstances of his life, that the Lord was overshadowing his life and had a greater and deeper purpose for his life than he was even fully aware of at that time. So where does the Lord take David? Where does the Lord take him in his first stop in his wilderness journey? He takes him to the same place where Jacob met the Lord in his own personal wilderness journey. So we've got a three-layered wilderness theme here. David is leaving the promised land, returning to the wilderness. It's the same general area where Israel had been in the wilderness before entering the promised land, and it's the same location where Jacob had his own personal wilderness experience with the Lord. And why would he take him to Mahanaim, the place of two camps? To remind David, this is not just about your camp and the soldiers that are around you and what you're going to do to preserve your life alive from Absalom's attempt to kill you. I'm camped here, and you're camped here. It was a reminder to him of the Lord's place in his life and where his ultimate and true safety and security was. And while he was there, camped at two camps, his camp and the Lord's camp, the Lord made provision for him, special provision, awesome, wonderful, spiritual provision. The Lord stirred the hearts of three resourceful men. I say resourceful in that three men who had been blessed with great resources. And these three men gathered all of the goods that we see described in verses 28 and 29, and they brought these resources to David and provided for David and all of his followers with him, all of his army with him, all of his family with him. And they didn't provide just a little bit. They provided an abundance for him there in the wilderness. Now, what are we meant to think of? Well, I think the one thing we should be aware of is how the Lord provided for his people in the wilderness, how the Lord rained manna from heaven upon them, how the Lord made sure they were sustained in their own wilderness journey. And here, this is simply the Lord confirming to David's heart that while he's under the testing of the Lord, and while he is passing through consequences that are unavoidable now, to train his heart, to sanctify his heart, nevertheless, the Lord is going to protect him, and the circumstances of this chapter clearly reveal that the Lord was at work to protect him in ways that David couldn't even protect himself. And the Lord is going to provide for him. The Lord is going to make sure that he survives the experience and gets to where he needs to be in order for God's assignment and purpose for his life to ultimately be fulfilled. All right, we'll end there for our study today, and we'll save the events of the battle between David's forces and Absalom's forces that's going to unfold for us in chapter 18 by God's design. God bless.